Hello, and welcome to Science World. A team of excited astronomers in South America announced the first of its kind discovery this past week. They said that they found the first asteroid or minor planet that was surrounded by two rings, similar to the ring systems found around Saturn and three other gas giant Jovian planets. It seems that the tensions between Russia and Ukraine are starting to impact the ongoing cleanup at the site of one of the world's worst nuclear disasters. Scientists announced this week that they have built a customized copy of an entire yeast chromosome, which could lead to a better understanding of how the genes contained within these package of genetic material work together. And today on our one-on-one segment, colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer in the world, and a group of scientists in Indiana have come up with a new, more accurate, non-invasive screening tool that could help medical professionals better screen their patients for the disease. We'll talk with one of the lead researchers behind the development of the new screening method. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A team of astronomers in South America announced this week that they have discovered the first miniature planet with two rings circling it. Science World's Rebecca Ward tells us more.
Called Curriculo, this giant asteroid, which is also considered to be a centaur or minor planet, is thought to have originated from the Kuiper Belt, a vast collection of icy celestial objects located in the outer reaches of the solar system just beyond the orbit of Neptune, but was later tossed out of that location. Curriculo, which scientists say is about 250 kilometers in diameter, is currently located about 2 billion kilometers away from Earth between Saturn and Uranus, along with a few other centaurs. The astronomers involved in the investigation made their discovery of Curriculo's ring system as the object passed in front of a star on June 3, 2013. The observers noticed that the star seemed to disappear for a few seconds as Curriculo blocked its light as it passed in front of it in an event scientists call occultation. Two very short dips in the star's apparent brightness a few seconds before and after the occultation led the astronomers to believe that something surrounding the small celestial object was blocking the light. Team leaders said that after conferring with their colleagues and comparing notes of observations made at seven South American observatories, they were able to not only recreate not only the shape and size of Curriculo, but also the shape, width, orientation, and other properties of the object's newfound rings. The two narrow rings surrounding Curriculo are only about 7 kilometers wide for one ring and 3 kilometers wide for the other. The rings are separated by a gap of about 9 kilometers. The researchers aren't exactly sure how the ring system was formed, but a team member theorized that the rings may actually be in the middle of a process that could someday produce a moon that will orbit Curriculo. If the two rings around Curriculo gather and form a moon, it's thought that it will be approximately 2 kilometers in diameter, according to the researchers. The rings were given two temporary nicknames, Oiapoque and Chi, named after two Brazilian rivers. I'm Rebecca Ward for Science World.
The tensions between Russia and Ukraine have begun complicating the ongoing cleanup at the site of one of the world's worst nuclear disasters. Steve Herman reports from Chernobyl in Ukraine.
In northern Ukraine, close to the border with Belarus, the world's largest movable structure is being built. When finished, the 250-meter-wide steel arch is to slide 200 meters to cover the sarcophagus, hastily built after the 1986 explosion to entomb Chernobyl Reactor No. 4. Our driver has made more than 500 trips to this spot, none lasting more than 15 minutes. His Geiger counter shows the limited effectiveness of the old sarcophagus, which is in danger of collapse.
This is actually a perimeter of a nuclear power plant, clean area. So radiation doesn't go from the ground, doesn't go from soil. It goes directly through sarcophagus.
Tons of radioactive material shot into the sky when that reactor blew its top. The resulting fallout blanketed Belarus and Ukraine. But the Soviet government in Moscow did not raise a public alarm. It would be scientists in Sweden who told the world that something ominous had occurred here. Farmer Ivan Semenyuk says if Soviet authorities had told villagers they would never be able to return home, There would have been panic, and perhaps many of the 120,000 people in the area would have refused to leave.
They lied to us. I took only 20 potatoes and a kettle. I fled in my broken-down car.
But Semenyuk and his wife have illegally returned home to tend to a small wheat field and raise some chickens and a pig, just 12 kilometers from the accident site. Most of a 30-square-kilometer exclusion zone remains an eerie ghost town, off-limits to all but cleanup workers and some officials who may spend no more than 15 days per month inside. A top Ukrainian communist official at the time, Leonid Kravchuk, who had become independent Ukraine's first president, visited the site 2 days after the explosion.
Of course, the Ukrainian intelligentsia, Ukrainian scientists, and those who were politically savvy saw that Moscow would never tell the truth to Ukraine. They knew that Moscow always wanted to see Ukraine under its thumb.
28 years later, those initial Ukrainian suspicions are full-fledged animosities following Russia's annexation of Crimea. Ukrainian officials say Russia has abandoned its G8 duties to lead fundraising for the sarcophagus cost overruns, totaling hundreds of millions of dollars. Ukrainian lawmaker Valery Kalchenko.
Now they will leave us on our own to finish the construction of the new sarcophagus, and it is hugely uncertain whether they will provide the portion of the funds that they took responsibility for.
There are warnings time is running out to avert a second Chernobyl catastrophe due to the precarious condition of the sarcophagus.
This is why it is very important for us today not to lose time. Perhaps we have 3 to 4 years left to finish the construction.
But even when the new protective arch is slid into place, the dangerous work will not be finished. Removing spent fuel and other highly radioactive materials will take decades and cost many more billions of dollars, a tremendous financial burden for Ukraine. Steve Herman, VOA News, Chernobyl.
Just heard about how the increasing tensions between Russia and Ukraine are beginning to complicate the cleanup of the former Chernobyl nuclear power plant, site of one of the world's worst nuclear disasters. For today's Science World Quick Quiz, from the following, what fissile nuclear material was used to fuel the Chernobyl nuclear power plant? Was it A, plutonium-239, B, uranium-235, or C, uranium-233? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
It is a major step forward in genetic engineering. Scientists have built a customized copy of an entire yeast chromosome. Steve Barragona has the story.
Johns Hopkins University professor Jeff Buca says it started with a coffee shop conversation with a colleague.
I mentioned casually to him that, well, of course we could make a yeast chromosome if we wanted to, but why on earth would we want to do that? And he practically, literally started jumping up and down with excitement when I told him that.
So Buca, the colleague, Srinivasan Chandrasekaran, and a third partner, Joel Bader, spent the next year discussing how they would engineer the chromosome to make it worth the enormous investment of time and money it would take. They decided to create an artificial version of chromosome 3, one of the smallest of yeast's 16 chromosomes. It carries about 100 genes. Buca says scientists have studied it for years.
It is, in fact, the sentimental favorite of yeast geneticists.
Buca and his colleagues recreated their favorite chromosome, gene by gene, with synthetic chemical building blocks. They included molecular seams so they could cut the chromosome apart, take some genes out, add others, rearrange them, and stitch it back together in ways that would help them understand how different combinations of genes work together. And since yeast genes are a lot like ours, the research could lead to a better understanding of human genetics.
And perhaps most interesting of all, we think it will be useful for actually improving the strain under a certain condition of growth or production of some useful product.
Different strains of yeast are already used to produce antibiotics, anti-malarial drugs, vaccines, biofuels, and much more. The ability to custom tailor chromosomes could give the biotech industry a boost. And Buca says the same process his group used to build a new yeast chromosome could be used in plants and animals and even humans as well. He says they are all aware of the ethical issues that could raise.
We have a card-carrying bioethicist who's part of our team, and we think a lot about these things. In fact, our whole field is infused with a passion for doing the right thing.
He says every member working on the project has to sign an agreement not to do what he calls bad things with it. Experts note that this is not the first time researchers have built a big chunk of genome from scratch. A group at the J. Craig Venter Institute synthesized an entire bacterial genome in 2008. That group was funded entirely with private money. Buca's group relied on a single, relatively small government grant. Virginia Tech professor Jean Pécou notes that undergraduate students did much of the actual work.
There is a lot of significance in terms of engaging students and using a research project like this as a training opportunity, but in terms of, you know, the kind of infrastructure, the kind of intensity and things like this that you need for a project like this, you know, is it really something that is fundable through public sources, or is it something that's going to be more in the hands of commercial interests?
Pécou notes that Craig Venter also used private money to sequence the human genome faster than the publicly funded project. Meanwhile, researchers still have 15 more chromosomes to build in order to reach their goal of constructing an entirely custom-made yeast genome. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
A blowfly is a common metallic blue, green, or black insect that hangs around garbage and dead animals around the world. As Roseanne Skirbel reports, a British research team has developed a tool to look at the fly in a new way, from the inside out.
Scientists from Oxford University and the Paul Scherrer Institute are the first to make high-speed 3D images inside a living flying insect. The idea was to study the blowfly's complicated joint system, says Oxford University professor Graham Taylor, a member of the research team.
Not only that, it's very fast and very small, so the wings beat 150 times a second or thereabouts. And each one of those wing beats is controlled by some tiny muscles, some of which are as thin as a human hair. So this is really an enormous technical challenge to understand this, and a particularly challenging target for understanding biological systems.
Writing in the journal PLOS Biology, Taylor says he and his colleagues wanted to detail the fly's mechanics, particularly its steering muscles that make up just 3% of its total flight muscles, yet control the output of the much larger power muscles.
And so the fly has overcome this problem by way of a very complex system, which is all based inside the fly. The problem with looking inside something is that visible light doesn't penetrate into it. And so what we need to use is X-rays, just as you would use to look at a bone fracture, say.
The rapid wing beat, 50 times in the blink of a human eye, required that the team turn to very fast imaging.
We take the fly to a particle accelerator called a synchrotron, and we put the flies into a powerful beam of X-rays, and we spin them around very rapidly. As the fly is spinning around, you're able to capture radiographs from different viewing angles, and by putting those together as it's beating its wings, you can reconstruct in three dimensions how the flight motor looks at all of the different stages of the wing beat.
And what they saw was a fly's mechanics.
The power muscles, rather than driving the wings directly, what they do is actually vibrate up and down the body. And those vibrations are communicated through a complicated hinge into the wings themselves. What the muscles that control the wing beat are doing, and this is what we've been looking at, is to just tweak the output at the wing hinge to which they attach directly and thereby change the shape of the wing beat that results.
Taylor compares that hinge action to what happens to our calf muscles when we walk down a steep hill.
And that pulling your calf muscles is because they're taking up the energy that you're gaining, the kinetic energy, as you descend down the slope. The fly is doing something very similar, absorbing that energy and diverting it into a different muscle.
Taylor expects the technique devised for these observations will be used to track other small living organisms or make its way into new micromedical devices. For a closer look at that fly, why don't you buzz on over to voanews.com. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Let's get back to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Do you think you have the right answer? Well, we want to know from the following. what fissile nuclear material was used to fuel the Chernobyl nuclear power plant? Was it A, plutonium-239, B, uranium-235, or C, uranium-233? The answer is B. The Chernobyl nuclear power plant's four Soviet-made RBMK-1000 nuclear reactors used uranium-235 for its fissile nuclear material. And all three choices in today's quiz have been used to power various nuclear reactors around the world. But both plutonium-239 and uranium-235, along with powering reactors, have also been commonly used as fissile material in nuclear weapons. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
Colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer in the world. The World Cancer Research Fund International said that 1.4 million new cases of this type of cancer were diagnosed in 2012, and the World Health Organization said 694,000 people died from the disease in 2012. Fortunately, according to the American Cancer Society, the mortality rate from colorectal cancer has continued to decline over the past 15 years, if it is detected early before it has a chance to spread. Colorectal cancer is very treatable and can often be cured. There are several methods that are being used to screen for colorectal cancer. Some are relatively simple, while others, like the colonoscopy, is a bit involved and usually requires the patient to be sedated while undergoing the outpatient procedure at a local hospital or medical clinic. Some people, with their doctor's guidance, often opt to be tested first with the less complex methods, such as the fecal immunochemical disease, where a small sample of the patient's stool was analyzed in a medical laboratory. If the test comes back positive, the patient is usually advised to get a colonoscopy, which is considered by many medical professionals as the gold standard in detecting colorectal cancer. But the fecal immunochemical test, according to researchers at Indiana University and Regent Streiff Institute in Indianapolis, Indiana, detects only 73.8% of colon cancers. So a number of patients who took the test are often sent on their way for a colonoscopy for more testing. The Indiana researchers have come up with a new, non-invasive colorectal cancer screening tool that they say detects 92.3% of colon cancers, a bit more accurate than current tests. Their test has not yet been approved for sale by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and they say it's not intended to replace the colonoscopy as a screening tool. Dr. Thomas F. Imperiale, M.D., is the lead author of the study that provided details about the research and findings about his team's new non-invasive colorectal cancer screening tool. Dr. Imperiale joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about colorectal cancer and how this new test can better help people determine if they might have or might not have this disease. First of all, Doctor, how widespread is colon cancer?
Well, it's the second most common cancer in men and women combined, both in incidence and mortality. So it's relatively common. The lifetime risk is about 5%. The risk of developing it, the risk of dying from it, is about 2.5%.
Now, what factors contribute to someone getting it or not?
There are very rare hereditary conditions, and that wasn't part of the study, that contribute to it. Those are what we call the hereditary polyposis and non-polyposis syndromes. And then the main risk factors are, you know, older age, male gender, and there are other risk factors for it that have to do with lifestyle, so cigarette smoking, having a high body mass index, or so being overweight, carrying a lot of your weight in your midsection. Those are the main risk factors for it.
I understand that the common diagnostic tool for checking for colon cancer is the colonoscopy. What is the difference between what doctors find with a colonoscopy versus what they would find in a non-invasive test, such as the one you and your team developed?
Colonoscopy, and you mentioned diagnostic colonoscopy, so that is the way colonoscopy was used before it was used for screening, which is when you're testing asymptomatic people who are healthy. Okay, so they're not complaining of any digestive symptoms, no colon symptoms such as change in bowel habit, rectal bleeding, anemia, that kind of thing. So that's when we use it in a diagnostic setting. And it was only around 13 or 14 years ago when the concept that colonoscopy could be used as a screening tool became accepted and became reimbursed. Prior to that, we had sigmoidoscopy, which sees about half the colon, used as a screening test, as well as fecal occult blood testing. And those really are more true screening tests in that they are simpler, easier, less expensive, less risky. But if you have a positive test, then you go on to get colonoscopy. So then, you know, around 2001, our study showed that you could do colonoscopy safely in people, and you picked up more. And that was really not news. We always knew that would be the case. What was news, perhaps, would be the safety of it, in that the risks stayed pretty low in terms of perforation, bleeding, et cetera. So whenever you have an indirect test, such as a fecal occult blood test or a fecal DNA test, when that test is positive, you are going to need a colonoscopy for evaluation of that test result. But if the tests stay negative, the thinking is that the disease is absent and you don't require colonoscopy.
I noticed that in reading about your new test that it detects 92.3% of colon cancers. Is there more than one kind of colon cancer?
Well, there are different cancers of the colon, but the one, when people talk about colorectal cancer, they refer to adenocarcinoma, an epithelial cancer of the lining of the colon. There can be other cancers, and other cancers can metastasize to the colon, but you could have lymphoma involving the colon. You can have these rare neuroendocrine tumors of the colon. They're so rare that they're you don't screen for them. We don't screen for them. But when you do a screening colonoscopy, you could pick those up. Those kinds of cancers would not be detected by any of these indirect tests, but they are so rare that they're virtually unseen. When they are found, at least a neuroendocrine tumor, they're usually self-contained and can be removed because they're usually the size of a polyp.
Tell us a little bit about it.
We call it a multi-component test, so it measures certain kinds of mutations in DNA or what we call epigenetic changes, so changes to gene structure that occur after that gene is produced, as well as looking for human hemoglobin in stool. So it's testing for a number of different things that can be altered in colorectal cancer. It uses a weighted multivariate equation. So it takes each test result and puts it into an equation and comes up with a score. And depending on what the cutoff for that score is, the test would be considered positive or negative.
Okay, let's find a little bit about how you and your team developed this new tool. What kind of research went into it?
You know, a lot of the tool was developed by the co-author David Ahlquist, and his work really in this area began about a decade ago, perhaps even longer. And the company itself has been working for 20 years to develop this kind of test. So many people have come before in terms of contributing the basic science to the test. A lot of preliminary research was being done, first starting with identifying genetic abnormalities in the tissues, so in the colon cancers themselves, and then determining whether you could identify those same abnormalities in the stool itself. And the big change that's occurred between this test and the one a decade ago has been improved identification, so better markers and better ways of recovering them and amplifying them for identification. Those have been the big changes.
And finally, Doctor, what advantages do you think this new test will offer versus others that have been around for a while?
Ultimately, providers and payers and patients will let us know that, but, you know, this provides a non-invasive option for what's out there. It's more sensitive than the fecal immunochemical test is alone. Its trade-off is that it's less specific, so it's going to send more patients to colonoscopy for, you know, false positive reasons. However, depending on how subsequent analyses with the test goes, it may allow a non-invasive screening test to be done less frequently than annually.
That was Dr. Thomas F. Imperiale, M.D., of the Indiana University School of Medicine and the Regent Streiff Institute in Indianapolis, Indiana. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.